Good morning, Your Honors. Your Honor, first I'd like to clarify that we really believe this should be a very simple, straightforward case. It should be a case where this court is reviewing a refund claim based on the statute of limitations under Section 6501. This court has done that many times in the past, and there's a strong body of law as to how those cases proceed. I refer to Arms, J.H. Rutter Rex, and Payne, all cited in our briefing. In those cases, the court holds that when the taxpayer pleads a 6501 statute of limitations, it is then the government's, if he establishes that the assessment was outside that normal period, then it is the government's duty to come in and show an exception. And that is the same procedure that should be applied here. In applying that approach would be completely consistent with this court's former TEFRA-related cases, including Kurzbeck and Wiener. Now, Judge Atlas and the government contend that our position is contrary to the Wiener opinion. That is not the case. It is actually hand in glove with it. Because to adopt the government's current position and the determination that comes in the Matthews case and the Scott case would, in fact, overturn a part of Wiener. Because in Wiener, there were two affected items that were the basis of that refund claim. The other was 6621C. The government would now have this court say that it never has jurisdiction over an affected item refund case, which is senseless. That would make the decision in Wiener void as not having the court not having jurisdiction over it. It would also mean that, for example, if a taxpayer's assessment was made more than a year after his settlement or his decision went into effect, that statute of limitations, 6501 case, would be barred because that's still an affected item. It would also mean that a refund claim by a taxpayer after a TEFRA assessment that he had overpaid his medical expenses and therefore had a clear overpayment would be barred under 7422H because that is an affected item. That just stretches 7422H way too far. And in fact, the plain language of 7422H is clear on that. The language of 7422H refers only to partnership items. For a comparison, if you look to a related TEFRA refund statute, 6230 subsections, several of them, include the terms attributable to a partnership item, paren, or an affected item, close paren, where Congress meant to include both, it clearly articulated both. And in 1997, in 6230D6, where it had previously said partnership items, paren, or affected items, Congress intentionally amended D6, but not the other references, to remove or affected items. The fact that 7422H refers only to partnership items with no additional reference to affected items, I think makes absolutely and abundantly clear that it means what it says. Now, Wiener was correct in that in a 6501 refund case, the court does not have jurisdiction to come in and make new partnership item determinations. And you have to go back to the history of how the courts have treated the statute of limitations in TEFRA-related cases. From 1982, with the enactment of TEFRA, up until Rome-Polnick in 2000, the tax court had consistently treated Section 6229 as if it were an independent statute of limitations. So had most of the other courts around the country. In 2000, Rome-Polnick came down from the tax court, a fully reviewed opinion, that said, no, that's not correct. There is only one statute of limitations. It is 6501, the non-TEFRA statute. And what 6229 in TEFRA does is create possible exceptions or extensions to that statute. The Court of Appeals for D.C. adopted that approach in a clear opinion. The Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit adopted that approach in AD Global. This court, most clearly of any court in the land, articulated that interrelationship in Kurzbeck. It says very clearly that 6501 is the controlling statute of limitations, and Section 6229 may create exceptions to it. That is even recognized or articulated in the opinion in this case. But then the court goes on and says, but because the defense under Section 6229, the government's potentially available exception, is a partnership item, that it does not have jurisdiction over the entire Section 6501 claim. And that's where the error rests. It does not have jurisdiction, not as a result of 7422H, but as a result of Section 6221, which says that in a partner-level proceeding, that partnership items may not be newly determined. What it actually says is that all partnership items shall be determined in a partnership, at the partnership level. That restricts the jurisdiction in a partner refund case like this from allowing the court to go in and make new determinations at the partnership level. So what the government must do is exactly what has been held in many other cases, the taxpayer must do in many instances. The government has to come forward where it has the burden of proof now to establish an exception and show that it had determined at the partnership level in a manner binding on Matthews that there were facts that established the exception. Now, that could have been done had they requested and Matthews agreed in his settlement documents that there was no valid partnership return or that there had been a valid extension of the statute of limitations. That was not done. It wasn't requested. It wasn't asked. The argument has been made that Matthews should have thereafter still been bound by the outcome of the TEFRA case. But in this case, unlike Wiener, the court held that the statute of limitations had not been resolved because all partnership items hadn't been resolved. But the government has judicially admitted in this case that the Matthews settlement was intended by the parties to conclude all partnership items. In that case, if Matthews ever had been a party to the TEFRA proceeding, he ceased to be when his settlement became effective. No subsequent actions in that case could be binding on him. Furthermore, he settled several years before the tax matters partner ever even intervened. Concessions or agreements by the tax matters partner could not bind Matthews. As I said, the proper question now should be whether the government can show that there is a binding exception under 6229, and the district court has jurisdiction to hear from the government whether it can show that. It may not go in and make new determinations that as to whether or not a partnership return was valid. It can't make new determinations as to whether or not there was an extension that might have applied to him. But it can look at all binding partnership determinations. In this case, what that should be, we believe, is to look at Matthew's settlement documents and to look at the return as filed.
Well, how does your case differ from the Prati case?
Prati?
Yes.
It differs in that we believe Prati is flat wrong, Your Honor, and we are, in fact, re-arguing those same issues before the Court of Federal Claims now based on the recent Supreme Court rulings on how you determine what is jurisdictional and what is not.
Right, but, I mean, aside from that, this is a 2010, and you were representing, and it involves the same
involved other partners and other partnerships.
It's a very similar case to this one, and Judge Bryson held there was no jurisdiction.
Your Honor, I agree, but what Prati did is exactly what I'm urging this court not to do. What Prati did is said that because you have a statute of limitations and then you have possible exceptions under TEFRA, that somehow makes this a partnership item, makes the statute of limitations a partnership item, but that can't be. It makes it an affected item. It clearly has elements that have to be determined at both partner and partnership level.
Well, but, I mean, in Weiner, whichever that case was, we clearly said that the FPA statute of limitations issue is a partnership item.
Your Honor, that is correct, and that is the way we argued it. We were trying to prove up the merits of 6229, and that's where I went into the history of TEFRA. At the time we argued that case, and at the time we pled it as a 6229 separate statute of limitations. But it is clear now that that whole line of reasoning was erroneous. Kurzbeck makes that abundantly clear. Roan Polnick makes it clear. Andotech makes it clear. Even in the Federal Circuit, its prior opinion in J.D. Global makes that clear. The opinion in Matthews actually says that we have raised the 6501 statute of limitations and the government may have a defense under Section 6229. That's a completely different analysis than the way Weiner was argued, presented, tried, and heard. And Weiner was consistent with the then prevailing thought that 6229 was a separate statute of limitations. To hold now that it is would be overturning Kurzbeck. But Kurzbeck is consistent with Weiner to the extent that Weiner was correct, that what we tried to do in that case, which was for us believing we had the burden of proof, to come in and prove the facts related to the potential extensions under 6229. That whole process is turned around when you look at Kurzbeck. It is up to the government to prove the extension. This court has for decades held that. And if that is the case, and if the prior precedent in this court is followed, that is the way it will come down. And the government may be able to do that. If the case is remanded for the district court to consider whether the government can establish its exception, I don't believe they can. But
of course, what Judge Atlas responded to on that score was that this is jurisdictional and the petitioner has the burden to establish jurisdiction.
But, Your Honor, it's not. It's up to the government to show that that the court has jurisdiction over its affirmative defense to our claim. And I will say that it does not have jurisdiction to go in and consider the merits of the facts the government wants to present. What it does have jurisdiction to do is to apply any prior partnership-level determinations that are binding.
Maybe this is a red herring, but what about the argument that I think the government makes that the partnership tax return in this case wasn't valid until much later because, you know, the proper partner didn't sign it?
That, Your Honor, is exactly the point. That argument is now asserting for the first time facts at the partnership level that the court cannot go in and make a new determination as to. If Matthews had agreed in his settlement that there was no valid partnership return, the government would have its defense. If Matthews had signed an extension of the statute of limitations or agreed in his settlement documents there was a valid extension, the government would have its defense. It was the government's burden to establish and preserve that defense at the partnership level. If it had done so, it could clearly now rely on it. The whole interplay here comes about in part, Your Honor, because of the change in the law in 1997. Prior to 1997, the statute said that Matthews, if his statute of limitations had run, he was not permitted to be a party in the TEFRA proceeding. It also provided that in the TEFRA proceeding, no individual partner-level issues could be considered. That precluded a partner from coming in and arguing that his individual statute of limitations had run. That law was changed in 1997, and for tax years after 97, this issue could be tried at the partnership level. It could not have been tried at the partnership level, the ultimate 6501 statute, prior to 1997. In fact, this court has very recently handed down a decision that applies the new statute. in Burks, which, and I apologize to the court, we misstated the status of the Burks case in our opinion. I was appalled when I went back and reread it. We said it was a partner level refund case. It was not. It was a partnership level TEFRA case in which the individual partner in a post 97 year came in and said, the government is relying on the non-TEFRA 6-year statute of limitations, arguing I understated basis.
Well, we'll take notice of that, but your red light's on.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. Ms. Del Sol?
Good morning. May it please the court. The government also thinks this is a simple case because I think this case has been this issue has been decided already. 6 courts of appeals, including this court in I assume it's Weiner. I'm not sure. I was guessing Weiner, so if I misstated, forgive me. But in these 6 cases, in 6 different courts of appeals, the statute of limitations has been held to be a partnership item. And in 4 circuits, those cases have been refund suits where the courts applied 7422H and said that therefore there wasn't jurisdiction over the refund suit because the statute of limitations is a partnership item.
Do you have any quarrel at all with the way in which Judge, and speaking very objectively, with the way in which Judge Atlas ruled on the case?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it's an accurate opinion below. And I think the Pratty case, it follows the Pratty case, which I think is directly on point here. And in fact, in Pratty, it's essentially an identical case, as was the Weiner case involving an Amcor partnership, the same sort of situation. And there, the taxpayers tried to make the same argument that they're making here, that the statute of limitations should be split into these 2 different types of claims, a 6501 claim and a 6229 claim. And I think as this court made clear in Kurzbeck, and as the Pratty court and also the AD Global court in the Federal Circuit.
Speak a little more slowly.
Certainly,
because
Your Honor.
We listened to the oral argument tape, but you're talking so quickly that if I listened to it, I'm not sure I still could understand it.
Certainly,
Your
Honor.
Put it in a slow mode.
Okay. Both the Pratty case and the AD Global case in the Federal Circuit and the Andantec case in the D.C. Circuit, like this court's opinion in Kurzbeck, recognize the statute of limitations in TEFRA matters intertwines 6501 and 6229. You don't look at just one or the other. You look at what the period is for the additional partner, then how it's extended under Section 6229, which requires figuring out what those time periods are, requires looking at a lot of different partnership items always. I mean, you have to look at, under 6229, when the partnership return was filed, whether there are any extensions because of any fraud, how the partner was involved in that fraud, whether it was the partner actually was actively involved or some other partner was involved in the fraud. You look at, as it was relevant with respect to this partnership, whether a valid partnership return was filed. So all those issues bring into play partnership items for what is really one statute of limitations inquiry that involves these 2 statutes.
When the 6501 statute of limitations, when it gets extended for partnership items by 6229, would be an affected item, right?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
I think, as the Pratty Court explained, because these 2 statutes are so intertwined and they work together, it wouldn't be an affected item because affected items are things that really are very unique to the individual partner and that can just sort of automatically be decided without intertwining any partnership issues. And because you have to look at the Section 6501 time period and then combine that with the Section 6229 time period, the Pratty Court concluded that the whole inquiry is a partnership item. And I think a number of other courts, maybe the Shimlo Court and I believe the Williams Court, both described the statute of limitations generally as a partnership item without even, before Kurzbeck and that line of cases breaking apart.
How does that affect taxpayers' other issues? Because presumably, when the IRS comes back on a taxpayer like Scott or Matt, the Matthews before him, her, it reviews the entire tax situation, does it not?
Well,
not just that the partner, not just how the K-1 affected that individual partner, but also how that interacts with other gains and losses in the partner's overall tax return, right?
Well, to the extent there are issues that are unique to that individual partner, that could be the 6501 statute of limitation applies if they're not partnership items. And if they're affected items, like an example would be a medical expense deduction,
which is a medical expenses deduction,
which is limited.
Right, gross income.
By gross income, and so if a partnership item was decided at partnership level and that affected gross income, then that could be adjusted in a suit brought
so
by the
limitations.
Partner.
So the court would not be without jurisdiction in that situation.
And with respect to just
the medical
making the adjustments. I mean, I think the usually that's not something that would be likely to generate a refund suit because it's very.
I understand.
But I think to the extent that it involves a partnership. And to the extent it involves a partnership issue, the court couldn't proceed to deal with
that.
I mean, I think the Chimblow court case in the Second Circuit addresses that.
It just seems to me that there is a risk in this train of cases that the government has pursued, and maybe it was cured by the statute that allowed the partners to participate at the partnership level, but apart from that, there seemed to me like a risk that the individual taxpayer would, that the court would lose jurisdiction over other bona fide items that the taxpayer might, have involved with his claim about the partnership.
Well, I think Section 7422H does extend to things attributable to partnership items. So the language is broader than just solely if it relates to a partnership item, and I think this court recognized that in Duffy. But I think, even before 1997, in many of these cases, the courts, and Chimblow is an example, that was an effective item deficiency proceeding after the partnership proceeding was over. That court said the partnership, the statute of limitations is a partnership item, and that issue couldn't be raised then. And so that was an authority dealing with earlier years. That goes, as is the Prati case that dealt with pre-1997 years, and those cases have all said that statute of limitations issues have to be are partnership items, and they have to be raised in the partnership proceeding, or they can't be raised later. And I think it's always been sort of a matter of Buckner law, and I think we cite some cases, I believe 19 in our brief, that indicate that the courts have jurisdiction to decide jurisdiction. And I think that under that principle, the tax court could always look at who should be in the case. I mean, Section 6226, I think, very clearly provides jurisdiction over the partnership level proceeding. And then in 6226D, it says all partners are parties, and then it says, partners who lack an interest in the outcome are not included in C, basically. So basically they're not parties if they don't have an interest in the outcome. And I think this is really a personal jurisdiction standing question that the courts generally have held that they have jurisdiction to decide. So if somebody came in and raised jurisdiction or standing, the court could decide whether you could be in the suit. And there were cases in the tax court, we cite several in our briefs, that said, you can just have the partnership, have the statute of limitations decided. You can go in and have that decided in the tax court even before 1997. And I think necessarily all the appellate decisions that said the statute of limitations is a partnership item and 7422H is a bar, it follows that it must have been that you could raise it in the partnership level proceeding even before 1997.
How about responding to the contention that while this might be well and good absent the settlement, that the settlement makes this distinguishable from everything you've been saying and from Judge Jones's opinion in Wiener?
Well, I don't think that's the settlement does make that different here. I mean, I think what TEFRA is a little unusual in that it you can settle certain items and not others, and so the other items can still be litigated in the partnership proceeding, whereas some can be settled. And here, it seems to me that taxpayers' argument is that they didn't settle the statute of limitations issue, and that was really the same issue, and so that's how they were able to come into court, because if they'd settled that issue, it would be settled, and we wouldn't be here.
The government had the settlement vacated, didn't it?
Well, there were two processes in the settlement here. What happened initially is that the taxpayer entered into a settlement way back when, back in the early
88 or something.
Yeah. where the taxpayer agreed, you know, I'll agree to certain 63% of the adjustments, and the taxpayer made a deposit and agreed to those amounts, and those amounts were computed, and the taxpayer the deposit was used to pay the tax and the interest thereon, and there was a refund of about $8,000. And then basically the government did think this case was resolved, it was settled. But then the taxpayer came forward and brought this refund suit, and the basis for the refund suit and the matter not being settled altogether is, well, the statute of limitations wasn't part of what was settled. And the government didn't dispute that because the documents here didn't tie down the statute of limitations issue. But if it's not settled, then the taxpayer is a partner in the partnership proceeding, and that's been the position the taxpayer took. And so that's how they are able to bring a refund suit, and this case isn't just resolved by settlement. And then subsequently, there was a second occurrence where this court decided the Wiener case, and it was viewed as a test case that would govern all the cases that were Amcor cases that presented essentially the same issue. After Wiener was decided, the government lost on the issue of the penalty interest under Section 6621C. And after that, the government agreed to refine penalty interest in a lot of cases. And apparently in this case, the taxpayers were supposed to have paid penalty interest under the initial settlement. And so, assuming that that had happened, the government agreed that they were going to refund the penalty interest. And that was the way this case was going to be resolved. And then when the government looked back at it, they discovered in their calculations that actually this taxpayer hadn't actually paid the penalty interest because the IRS did the computations wrong. So they'd only pay regular interest under the agreement where they were originally supposed to pay all the penalty interest as well. And so because of that mistake, the government sought relief from that agreed judgment that was based on the penalty interest. And then the taxpayers have then pursued, well, then we want that refund of the whole thing because we're arguing now that we're free to say that the statute of limitations is a bar. But if they haven't settled the issue, then they were partners to the partnership in the partnership proceeding, or they could have raised it there under all the case law that says you have to raise it there. And having not raised it, it's our view that they would be bound. But and so that they can't bring this refund suit under Section 7422H. Does that answer your question, Your Honor? It's a long and complex history, I realize. I'd just like to briefly address the suggestion the taxpayer made that the recent Supreme Court precedent somehow changes the jurisdictional issues with respect to Section 7422H. We think Henderson, which they've cited in numerous 28J letters, is a very different factual case and it's not controlling here. But to the extent it gives general jurisdictional guidance, I think it actually supports the government's position here. It talks about the factors that you look at as including the history of whether a statute has been treated as jurisdictional, how it works in the statutory scheme and how it's worded, and the placement of the statute in the code. Or in whatever statutory scheme you're dealing with. And here we have a situation where, as I've mentioned, four circuits have looked at 7422H and said that the statute is jurisdictional and creates a bar. And this circuit in Wiener is one of them. And additionally, this is a statutory scheme where Congress was trying to devise a scheme that would divide jurisdiction between the partnership proceeding for partnership items and making sure that in individual suits that there was no jurisdiction to raise the partnership items again because it wanted everything to be in one unified proceeding. Also, the wording in the statute about no action shall be brought is very similar to Section 7422A, which limits refund suits generally and has been held by the Supreme Court to be jurisdictional. And in fact, it's in the same section. So I think when you look at all these things together, it makes clear that Henderson doesn't change the situation, and that Wiener and the other circuits, like the Federal Circuit and Pratty, should govern here. And I would just like to point out that Pratty really is just like this case. And in fact, even Wiener, because it was the test case for this case, was really factually identical to this case. And I think Kirschbeck clarifies in this circuit that even though Wiener may have mentioned an FPI statute of limitations, that that really the statute of limitations is one inquiry that involves 6501 and 6229. And so you don't have, so it's really, this case is very similar to the Pratty case in that case, the Federal Circuit had precedent in Keener where the claim had been framed as a Section 6229 claim. And that court looked at that case together with its AD Global opinion, which, like Kirschbeck, said 6501 and 6229 together in tandem create the statute of limitations. And instead, based on those two cases, we conclude that this case is one where it's the statute of limitations claim is barred by 7422H also. Are there any other questions from the court?
I guess not.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Redding?
Please, the court. Your Honor, I think we have established jurisdiction to consider 6501 under 1340A, 1346A1, and I think the opinion even recognizes that. I would like to point something out that I think is important, though. If the Pratty-type analysis here is accepted, and this court now says it's the burden on the taxpayer to come in and disprove the government's asserted exception to 6501, that would overturn all of the prior precedent in this court on 6501, and actually the government should be asking for an en banc review to ask for that. Those cases are very clear. It's the government's burden to establish the exception. As far as 6229 and 6501 somehow being intertwined, making it a partnership item, all affected items are intertwined. That's what an affected item is. It's an item that has an element that is both a partnership item element and a non-partnership item element. 6501 statute of limitations sets out the non-partnership item elements of the statute of limitations, the primary prima facie statute. And then the possible exception or extension may be created under the TEFRA statutes involving partnership items, such as when the partnership return was filed, whether a valid return was filed, whether there was an extension at the partnership level. Those are partnership item determinations that go to whether or not there's an extension or an exception to 6501. But this court has a 30-year history of saying the burden to establish that is on the government, not on the taxpayer. The classification of affected items is well established under Petaluma and Jade Trading. That is how you determine what an affected item is. It's also the definition. It's statutory in the code. As to the government's arguments regarding Henderson, Your Honor, we don't dispute that 7422H is a jurisdictional statute. What we do dispute is that it should be so broadly interpreted as to include affected items, which was the point in my making the comparison back to Section 6230. And I would suggest that if that is an issue of interest to the court, that I'd like to renew our motion and our request for leave to brief Henderson to this court and how it applies. Because we think where the important application is really to the other jurisdictional statutes, to 6229, to 6226, to how 6221 apply, and the need to consider and give respect to those statutes that prohibit the partner from having participated at the partnership level if his statute of limitations had run, and which prohibited the tax court in the partnership level proceedings from looking at partner level issues, which until 1997 was the law, and it's the law that Matthews followed and abided by. And I'll point out that when that law was changed in 1997, there were several amendments to TEFRA. The legislative history makes clear that some of those amendments clarified prior law, but it says that the amendment to 6226 permits and gave it an effective prospective date. clearly showing that it was not a clarification of prior jurisdictional law on 6226. It was essentially a new grant of expanded authority to the tax court to consider the statute of limitations in a TEFRA proceeding, as this court recently did in Burke. The analysis in Kurzbeck of how 6229 and 6501 interrelate is absolutely accurate and clear. Even the opinion by Atlas, in Judge Atlas in this case, says that we have pled a statute of limitations claim under 6501, that the government asserts a defense to that claim under Section 6229. Now, if this court has jurisdiction over any 6501 cases, which clearly it does, it has jurisdiction over this case. It has jurisdiction over the matter. And we get to prove our basic case, and the government should be able to show whether or not there's an extension. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.